This is Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Recently, many U.S. celebrities opposing the war in Iraq have been singled out by conservative media pundits, which has led to a wave of firings and a deafening silence in mainstream media on the anti-war position. One recent instance of this was the cancellation of MSNBC's Donahue show last week. Rick Ellis, a columnist at AllYourTV.com, broke the story of an internal memo at MSNBC that illustrated the real concerns of cable networks, namely competing with Fox News. Pacifica's Peace Watch spoke with him earlier today.
Essentially what it said in its this particular memo is part of an ongoing discussion that was going on at the network. Specifically what this memo was a bit of a recap of the discussion that had been going on for several months there. One of the big concerns was that the Donahue show, and sort of specifically Donahue himself, was really perceived by the public and some of the executives there as being too liberal. And in an environment where liberal sometimes is translating into unpatriotic, there was a real strong concern that it was going to impact the network.
And so there's a difference between being perceived by the audience as too, quote, liberal or an ergo unpatriotic and being perceived by, you know, the executives there. Was it both, or was it more or less the ones that had control of the situation perceived him to be too liberal? And how did they know that the audience thought he was too liberal?
What was happening there was very early on, there were a lot of focus groups and a lot of testing being done of the show. And one of the things that came out in the focus groups was a lot of people perceived Phil Donahue as being anti-war. And that was troublesome for the network. And as the ratings didn't climb to a level that they were really looking for, a lot of people at the network translated that anti-war impression that people had to difficulty building an audience. I mean, there were obviously some other problems going on there, and this really isn't a 100% black and white sort of issue, but this really was a concern. And it wasn't so much people at the network having a strong moral conviction that they thought that he was anti-war or that he was too liberal. It really was more of a situation of, hey, we're business people. We don't want to be in a situation where we're having to apologize for Phil Donahue 24 hours a day.
So was it about the ratings or was it about the politics?
You know, any sort of network programming decisions, a lot of it's almost voodoo. Now, it's true that the network wasn't happy with the ratings level, particularly after the first 2 weeks. You know, the first week, a lot of people tuned in, and a fair amount of that audience went away. So it was ratings in the general sense. I guess really the question is, why weren't people watching? And then that really gets down to the liberal issue.
Mm. Well, Peace Watch spoke earlier today with Alan Winnikoff, a publicist for MSNBC. He refused to come on the air to be interviewed, but he claimed that MSNBC had no knowledge of this memo. And he said that Donahue was simply fired because his ratings were bad and that this sort of thing, you know, happens every day. What's your response to that?
Well, I guess my glib response is I also saw words from someone at the network saying that they weren't going to respond to anything that was on the Internet. So, you know, there was a certain amount of that initially. We don't know anything about it, et cetera, and a certain amount of effort to spin the story a little bit. And I understand that. What's happened really in the week since I wrote my piece is that you have a lot of other reporters out there talking to people at the network, people who used to work on the show, have very similar experiences talking to people and say, well, we got these memos from the network saying this. And so what you're really finding, I think, is that there's a pretty consistent tale out there from people, mm-hmm. that people on both sides of the issues are saying, yeah, this was really a serious question.
So how do you know your memo was authentic?
The source that I had originally, I was pretty happy with. This is someone I'd spoken with for a number of years. I was able to talk to two of the people who had received all or part of the memo and who were able to say, yes, I received that. I mean, I'm frankly very comfortable that it's legitimate. But I would not really expect in any sort of situation like this that the network would come out and say, yep, that was us.
You said in your columns that that for there to be an audience for a liberal talk show host in the mainstream media, there must be an entertaining and engaging person to compete with Fox. Yet Donahue's ratings were increasing in the weeks leading up to his firing. How do you explain that?
Well, you know, one of the things that people who work at the show will tell you is that they felt that really from very early on, MSNBC didn't allow Phil to be Phil.
Mm-hmm.
And what they really mean is that he wasn't allowed to be as free wheeling as, for instance, Bill O'Reilly is at Fox News. I mean, Bill O'Reilly sits there and he does the show he wants to do. And they were happy with him at the beginning. They were willing to let him get in there and find his voice. And they were comfortable that the ratings would follow. And really, that has to happen. If you're going to hire someone, particularly in this type of format that's part news, part talk, you really have to give someone the opportunity to go out and do this type of show that they want to do. And both sides will admit that there was a lot of micromanaging going on, particularly in the last couple of months. So the end result was that, yeah, the ratings were going up, but people from the show will argue that they would have went up even more had Phil been able to do the type of show that he wanted to do.
At the same time MSNBC has fired Phil, it's decided to hire conservative hosts like Michael Savage and Dick Armey. And I have a statement here from Donahue that I just wanted to read a segment from. It says, quote, "We were hoping to break through the noisy drums of war on cable and become a responsible platform for dissenters as well as administration supporters. The New York Times op-ed page features a variety of views regarding the Bush war on Iraq, including regular columnists who have been quite critical of the administration's foreign policy team. MSNBC's voice should be no less diverse. The hiring of Mike Savage, Dick Armey, and Joe Scarborough suggests a strategy to outfox Fox.
The network will say, hey, we are hiring all these people to increase the range and the width of our voice and the spectrum of the type of people we have on here. But I think most people would look at it and say, these are generally fairly conservative people. So then really the question is, why were they hired? And there's really only two possibilities, one of which is that these people were better suited for the network than Phil Donahue, which certainly could be the network's opinion. The other side of it is they're all conservative. Phil Donahue is liberal. Geez, maybe it's because of their particular political beliefs and the audience that the network feels is going to get by hiring them. I certainly wasn't sitting in the network office that made the ultimate decision, hey, Phil must go. So I think it's up to the audience to decide which one of those two is more likely.
In your opinion, with the cancellation of Donahue and the language that, you know, that it's believed that these other people, these more conservative hosts, Dick Armey, Mike Savage, Joe Scarborough, might be better suited, and they have such a conservative bent, are you comfortable that MSNBC can actually be trusted to keep a watchful eye on Washington in this time of impending war with Iraq to serve the purpose that the media is supposed to serve in this country?
Well, I think people really have to look at it this way. While you think of those hosts, where you think of Bill O'Reilly at AL as being journalists, that's really not the situation. That's really not their function here. Their function isn't necessarily to keep a watchful eye on Washington in a traditional journalistic sense. These are people who are there to have some opinions and entertain people and get viewers. And not only get viewers, but get people very motivated to watch the show. And that's really the bottom line. I mean, mm-hmm. I think that sometimes people have misunderstood this, and really that's what Donahue was there for as well. Whether he's liberal or conservative, he was there to bring people to the table. Now, I really don't know if Phil would have been able to do it had they left him alone or not. But that's I don't think we should really confuse journalism with this entire discussion, because frankly, that really isn't what's going on here.
It's kind of like if we want you to have an opinion, we'll give you one. That old phrase.
Well, there's a certain amount of that. I mean, you really sort of have to think of this as people who host shows on mostly really the Fox News Channel and MSNBC, they are there in the function of almost being a magician. They're there, when you tune them on, you won't tune them off. And anything that they need to do to make that happen, really the network's happy with it. And one of the reasons that you're seeing the network standing behind some of the hires, for instance, like at MSNBC, is that they're happy people are just talking about the network. I mean, they look at that as a win-win situation. And if they hire someone and they have to get rid of them 2 months down the road because the public outcry is just too much for them to take care of, so be it. In the meantime, they've got a nice audience, and they've got people tuning in. And there's a certain amount of, yeah, we'll tell you what your opinion should be, and a certain amount of it is just, look, we'll say whatever we need to say to get you to tune in tomorrow.
Rick Ellis is a columnist at allyourtv.com. Many people feel the Bush administration has not made the case for an invasion of Iraq and wonder why this administration, against all conventional wisdom, is continuing to build up troops in the region. Peace Watch spoke to political commentator Ambrose Lane Sr., host of We Ourselves on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington, about what impact money has on the U.S. march to war in Iraq.
As of January 1st, 1999, there was created the European Monetary Union, and they created a common currency like the dollar called the euro. And if you take a look at what's happened to the euro and the dollar, today the Wall Street Journal reports that our dollar is worth about 91 cents in relationship to the euro.
And so how many countries actually use the euro?
There are 12 countries, European countries. There are two entities. The European Union comprises 15 European countries, but only 12 of those use the common currency, the euro.
Mm-hmm.
Excluded from that 15 are the United Kingdom, Sweden, and Denmark. The rest of the countries have one currency, the euro, and they pose a real serious problem to this country and the dollar. And what happened was Iraq started this slide of the dollar. In November of 2000, Iraq demanded United Nations approval to be paid in euros in the United Nations Oil for Food program, and then asked that the $10 billion held in New York in their frozen bank account be converted to euros. Now, the UN first resisted the change, but then Iraq, under Saddam Hussein, threatened to suspend all oil exports. Following them, Iran, and said that they were considering changing its holdings to euros instead of dollars. Some people in Saudi Arabia call for switching to the euro as what they call a more effective punishment for the United States. But there was a huge lawsuit filed in the country, and so they decided that several billion dollars of their holdings here must be converted to the euro from the dollar.
So
Russia's did the same thing.
Mm-hmm. So in other words, what you're saying is that the demand for the euro by oil-producing and oil-controlling states can actually threaten to diminish the value of the dollar.
Yes, and because we have such huge deficits and because President Bush did this huge tax cut for the rich, as a result, if there is a real run on the dollar by people switching to the euro, we are facing a depression like the Great Depression. And that's the big issue that the press simply has not told the people that's involved in this whole Iraqi war thing. They figure that if they can go over there and control the second largest known reserves of oil and are able to militarily threaten Saudi Arabia, which has the world's largest supply of oil reserves, then they can continue to demand that the world respect the dollar instead of the euro.
Well, so if Saddam Hussein stays in place by some unlikely chance, then that could seriously threaten the U.S. dollar.
Of course it can, yeah. And that's what the real thrust of this whole we have to have war is about.
So now, those in the peace movement who want to have peace in order to protect the innocent lives that might be lost or that would be lost in the event of a war, an invasion into Iraq, but don't necessarily want the U.S. dollar to die in the process, what would be a solution to that? Are there any
serious
geopolitical
political pressure on this administration as well as the Democrats in Congress to reverse the antagonistic attitude of this government vis-a-vis the rest of the world? I mean, you have to think of what they have done since they came to power. They dismissed the binding obligations of the Kyoto Protocol on climate change. They refused to be bound by the newly set up International Criminal Court. refused to sign the treaty banning anti-personnel mines. They dumped the process of strengthening biological weapons convention, rejected the comprehensive test ban treaty, which the previous administration was trying to force third world countries like India to sign, and is preparing to test a fresh generation of nuclear weapons, and has openly threatened the United Nations. Here is a country that owed the United Nations its dues for many years because of Jesse Ham. Now, Bush goes to them and says, you're going to become irrelevant. The arrogance of this administration and what it means in terms of diplomacy throughout the world. No one could deal with them. They were so arrogant, and they remain so. And what happened was we saw the Congress roll over and play dead. They gave him this unlimited authority directly contrary to the Constitution. That meant that all of the corporate world in this country was supporting what they were doing. And now we all stand to be hurt by this arrogant stupidity.
Mm. And Dr. Lane, finally, what do you see as the worst case scenario here and then the best case scenario?
Is that we go to war and we kill a whole lot of Iraqis and unleash on this world a tremendous retaliation, both at home and abroad, while we face real serious economic problem bordering on how things were during the Great Depression, because we owe so much money. We as consumers and we as a nation, we face deficits as far as the eye can see. And how in the world do you keep people from withdrawing their money from our assets? Because in 1979, what we did was increase the interest rates paid to 15% to 20%, and all of those people, and those are now running out. All of those governments and institutions and people who had the money would buy $10,000 bonds and receive between 15% and 20% interest for the next 30 to 40 years. And what was happening at the end of Clinton's term was they were using the surplus to buy up some of those so that we would have a surplus. And this guy comes in and just ruins all that by giving these tremendous tax benefits to the super rich, just as Ronald Reagan did in 1981. But now it's much more serious.
So what do you foresee as an outcome in the event that Saddam Hussein is out of the picture? How is the rest of the world likely to respond to this equation with the euro versus the dollar?
How is he going to get out of the picture except we assassinate him?
Well,
we've cut off diplomacy. And this president has said he wants to kill him.
Yes, well, if that is the outcome, what do you see? And the U.S., well, I guess it would just boil down to he who controls the oil wells.
There we go.
Controls the euro.
That's exactly right.
But if there's still greater demand from the other European countries for the euro...
Well, they have to be concerned about who controls the oil as well.
Political commentator Ambrose Lane, senior host of We Ourselves on Pacifica Station WPFW in Washington.
If we can change the course we're on, there is no future.
As the U.S. sends another 60,000 troops to the Persian Gulf, a group of Washington-area peace activists is distributing a statement calling on service members to refuse to fight, refuse to kill. Peace Watch spoke last week with Susan Crane, a member of the Jonah House community in Baltimore, Maryland, and one of the drafters of the statement.
are being ordered to war by a president who was never elected, who has never fought in a war, and who is saying that it is acceptable to use nuclear weapons. You are being ordered to war in the footsteps of veterans who, more than 10 years ago, were sent to fight the first Gulf War. Many of those vets returned with severe and unacknowledged illnesses. Many gave birth to severely deformed children. Many were abandoned by the Veterans Administration. You are being ordered to war by the most powerful nation on earth. You are being ordered to war by a nation with the most destructive weapons ever conceived, developed, deployed, or used. This nation can have no moral justification for war. We, the undersigned, are convinced that war is the greatest evil on earth. We believe that humankind must end war, or war will end humankind, and in fact, all of creation. Our convictions have driven us time and again to the Pentagon, the White House, and Congress in acts of civil resistance to war. Now we bring our plea to you, sisters and brothers in the armed forces. Refuse to kill. Refuse the order to go to war. Leave the military before it is too late. We know your resistance to war will be difficult and require great courage. There are groups established for the purpose of counseling and supporting military resistors. To find out about your right to conscientiously object to war, call GI Rights Hotline, 1-800-394-9544, or 1-800-FYI-95-GI. As you consider this plea, we ask that you reflect. Is non-cooperation more difficult than fighting in a war? Is non-cooperation more difficult than being a pawn of corporate greed? Is non-cooperation more difficult than living with a violated conscience? Is non-cooperation more difficult than living with the poisons of war in your body and spirit? Wrong is easy. Right is difficult and long. Do what your heart says is right. We knowingly and willingly make this plea to you in violation of 18 U.S.C. Section 1381 and 2387. We knowingly and willingly embrace some of your risk by urging you to refuse duty in the U.S. military. We plead with you as Bishop Oscar Romero pleaded with the Salvadorian troops. When you hear the words of a man telling you to kill, remember instead the words of God, thou shalt not kill. No soldier is obliged to obey an order contrary to the law of God. In the name of God, in the name of our tormented people who have suffered so much and whose laments cry out to heaven, I beg you, stop the repression. If you choose to leave the military, please know that our hearts and homes are open to you.
Jonah House member Susan Crane, the GI Rights Hotline number, once again, 1-800-FYI-95-GI. Finally tonight, a bit of political satire from the Christmas Coup comedy players at Pacifica Station's KPFT in Houston and WBAI in New York.
We now take you live to the Oval Office, where Vice President Dick Cheney and National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice are meeting with the President of the United States, George W. Bush.
So what I was saying is that I've decided to reinvent the wheel.
And that's good,
Mr. President.
That's
a long overdue, Mr.
Yes.
President.
Yes. And you are certainly the right man for the job.
Well, it's a big job because there are so many things wrong with the way the wheel is now.
Well, I would start with the worst thing about the wheel and fix that first.
The worst is first.
Yes. You save the best for last.
The strategy is perfect, Mr. President.
Mm-hmm. Well, strategizing is one of my strong points, Condi. Strategically speaking.
Yes.
Well,
yes.
And what is the the worst thing about the wheel, Mr. President?
Why do you ask me that, Dick?
Because you said the worst thing was the first thing you would fix when you reinvent the wheel.
Well, I'm glad you were listening. Dick, I'm glad you were listening.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. President.
Do you know what the worst thing about the wheel is, Dick?
No, I don't, Mr. President.
Why don't you tell him, Condi?
Yes, Mr. President. The wheel is not round enough.
Not round enough by half. Mm-hmm. It's unround.
The wheel must be made more round.
Are you satisfied now, Mr. Dick?
Well, I hope Hillary Clinton doesn't call your new wheel a myth, Mr. President.
Hillary Clinton called Homeland Security a myth.
Yes, she did, Mr. President.
We will make her regret it. You're upsetting the president, Dick.
Well, I'm sorry.
Homeland Security is not a myth. I have the evidence.
Oh, the evidence is good.
But you don't have to show it to everyone or anyone.
Well, we have protected San Francisco, where evil monsters like Godzilla has made no attacks.
Uh-huh. No, there were no reported attacks on San Francisco by Godzilla, Mr. President.
Mothra threatens to eat tall buildings in a city such as Seattle, Washington. Mm-hmm. But we have prevented Mothra from achieving its evil desires.
Well, that's good, Mr. President.
Homeland Security is a great success, Mr. President.
You have to focus on not being attacked.
Mm. Mm. And carry a big stick.
Beware the attack of conscience.
Ah. Power transcends conventional morality.
Well, two wrongs can make a right.
Well, they almost always do.
And three wrongs can make it even more right.
Uh-huh. The more wrongs, the merrier.
That's right. While I am planning my compassionate, conservative, limited annihilation of the city of Baghdad, I cannot afford to be attacked by my own conscience, so I get rid of it.
Well, it just gets in the way.
You have to eliminate your conscience. Otherwise, it's like harboring an inner liberal or progressive.
Exactly. I think I better get back to my work on the wheel.
Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. by Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. We had production assistance from Adil Hamad of KPFA, Patrick Higgins, Benta Berkland, Angelique Shofar, and Keith Chalgian. Thanks to Pete Karakis, RadioForAll.net, and Shane Rock at WebActive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producer, Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting the website at pacificaarchives.org or calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support this type of programming, we urge you to visit pacifica.org and make a pledge through our secure online website. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.